My name's Lee Manatic. It's always an honor to be asked to come and share it. You guys have asked me to come up here several times. I live in Charleston. I was born and raised in Charleston, so, but Barry reached out last week. He's like, come up. Yeah, sure. I'm not married. I don't have any children. If I'm not doing recovery, I'm probably getting in trouble. So I do a lot of recovery. This is all I know. I was talking to my man before the meeting, out there on the streets, like that drugs and alcohol are a lifestyle. Like that's all we know. And all I know today is recovery. Recovery is a lifestyle. And this is what I do. This is all I know today. And I wouldn't have it any other way. My life is wonderful today. And I'll say this now, I don't care who you are or where you are, or how you got there or what's going on. If you need some help, call me. Get my number, call me, find me on Facebook, reach out, send me a message. I will help you. It's a joy to watch other people get better. There's just nothing like it. My story is not the stereotypical story that you hear. There's two stereotypical stories about the disease. The first one is tragedy. It's broken homes and broken families and tragic lives and tragic occurrences. That's not my story. I was your typical middle class, 80s, Norman Rockwell kind of family. And, my parents loved each other. My brother and I still have a good relationship today. On the outside looking in, you wouldn't say, okay, this person's going to end up with this problem. That's just not what you would have seen. You would have seen, just some typical kid running the streets in some middle class neighborhood, The other story that we typically hear or that we typically tell in the disease is loss. We come into these rooms and we see, I lost my family, I lost my job, I lost my house. That's not my story either. I never acquired any of those things. So I never had any of those things to lose. I'm not going to say that I started drinking and using at an early age per se. But once I started drinking and using, there certainly wasn't any stopping. It wasn't hard for me to get good grades. It wasn't hard for me to be good at school. I made friends. It wasn't difficult at all. But right around the time I turned 13, though, started to become very aware of how cool I was or how cool you thought I was. And it took quite a few years in recovery to learn about these fears that drive us to make really, really poor choices, like the fear of what other people think and the fear of not being good enough and the fear of being alone. These fears drove me. I'm a fear-driven individual. I'll tell you right now, every four-step that I've ever written, every inventory that I've ever written, there's always been fear. It is the underlying driving factor. It is impossible for me to be upset with you or resentful at you. It's impossible for me to be selfish if there's not an underlying fear that I'm not going to get what I want or you don't like me or whatever. The first time I drank, I was 13. I spent the night at a friend's house and we snuck out. My brother had just graduated high school and we're walking down the street and this cat pulls up that had graduated with my brother and he was like, hey man, why don't you come over to the house? We're all partying. We went over there and it's this high school college rager. I'm 13 years old and I've arrived. I got blackout drunk that night. From the beginning, I exhibited the disease. From the beginning, I exhibited the allergy, this abnormal reaction to a common substance, this phenomenon of craving that kicked off in me, this I want more. And the book talks about the different types of drinkers on pages 21 and 22. And there's the moderate temperate drinker, the one who can take it or leave it alone. That's my mom. My mom is a moderate temperate drinker. I've watched her pour a glass of wine. She might drink it. She might not. That bottle of wine will stay open in her fridge for a week and she won't even look at it. I have no idea what that's about. That makes no sense to me at all. I don't get that, And look, I'll correlate that to, it's nice to be in an HA meeting where I don't have to just keep it to alcohol. Look, I use Zen, that nicotine powder stuff, Cause I finally quit, smoking on a regular basis cause that's like a good thing to do. I bought a can of Zen a month ago at this little store and I opened the can up and the pouches were defective. And so what I opened up was this can of nicotine dust. And I swear to God, the first thing that ran through my mind was, can I snort this? That it's just different, It's just different. I am not a moderate temperate drinker. You know, it's just the way it is. I got myself into a bit of trouble, or at least a bit of a trouble for a, you know, middle-class Norman Rockwell kid. I failed off the baseball team, and I got into a lot of trouble at school, and, you know, and so I quit drinking and using at that time, or I quit drinking at that time, or whatever you want to call it, because, you know, I got my parents on top of me or whatever, you know. I can tell you in retrospect that that was the last time in my career as an addict and alcoholic that I could stop on my own. But I hadn't had anywhere near the amount of consequences that we have to have to start taking a look at our behaviors. So, you know, it wasn't a thing. I was just some dumbass kid, you know. So fast forward 6 years, and I was at College of Charleston. I was 3 years into a four-year degree in U.S. history, and I got bored. Right around the same time, I had spent quite a bit of time at the pool room, you know, because that's a really good thing for a college kid to be doing when he's not at school, is to be hanging out at the pool hall. You know, and that's one of the other things that I have to really be honest and admit about myself. I'm not really comfortable around normal people. Like, I'm just not, dude. I am comfortable around addicts and alcoholics and criminals. That's who I'm comfortable being around. I got like 5 minutes with normal people. Like, it's the weather and sports, and after that, it's like, why am I talking to you? You know, it's just the bottom line. You know, I spend enough time around normal people, I start trying to be normal. That ain't gonna work. That is not gonna work. You know, so I dropped out of college. I started getting high again. I dropped out of college. Next thing I knew, I jumped in my buddy's truck, and we had drove across the country to Arizona because I was going to go start my life. I ended up in this little town called Kingman, Arizona. It's about half the size of, you know, Somerville. It's about half the size of Conway, in the middle of the desert. Nothing around. I got this little job at some grocery store. I was pulling shopping carts out the sand. Like, what am I doing here? You know? I spent like 3 weeks out there and figured out that wasn't the smartest thing to do, so I came back home, and instead of going back to school, which would have been, you know, the smart thing to do, you know, because left to my own devices, I don't make a whole lot of really good choices. Just gonna go ahead and put that. I don't know about you all, but, you know, when I follow directions, things go well. When I do what my parents told me to do, or my teachers told me to do, or my coaches, or my bosses, or my customers, when I do what somebody tells me to do, things go well. But when I'm left to my own devices to make my own choices and do it my way, clown show. This is what it is. I decided to start working at Money Man Pawn Shop. You know, if you were in Charleston between 97 and 2000 and you pawned anything, I might have been the guy that robbed you. I'm sorry. It was my job. It just was what it was. I don't remember a lot about those couple of years. The disease progresses, and we progress with the disease, and we just lose time. I lost a couple of years. I got a few memories that come back every now and again. Not real proud of any of that stuff, you know? The next thing I can really put together, it was early 03. I was living out on Folly Beach. I was working at some pool and spa joint in North Charleston. And, my first real red letter day as a addict and alcoholic came about. So I got paid on Friday. And so what that means is that I was broke Sunday morning, because that's how it works, right? You know, I'm paid Friday and then I'm broke real quick. Woke up Sunday morning, I drove down to the little market on the end of the beach, bounced a check for some beer, went back to the house and started drinking. And around noon or 1 o'clock, I had suddenly, the book talks about this, right? Suddenly, I had this thought. I'm just going to go drive into town and go and see my man real quick, right? Now, vaguely in the back of my mind, Lee, you don't need to be driving six deep into an empty pack, into an 18-pack on an empty stomach. Like, you need to be driving right now. Reassuredly, though, I do this all the time, right? Bright, beautiful Sunday afternoon in Charleston. I lost control of my car on the interstate. And I hit the wall, and I bounced off the wall, and I hit the wall again, and I bounced off the wall again, and the car backed itself into the emergency lane. And I didn't really get knocked out, but I was sort of in a daze. The airbag had blown me back into the right, and as I was kind of coming to, I looked to my left, and there was this dude, and he was standing on the interstate, like looking in the window. And I look behind him, there's like 12 cars behind him, just dead stopped on the interstate. And he sees me sort of come around and reaches over, and he grabs the handle on the car door, and the car door opened. And he said, "Hey man, are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah." And he grabbed me by my jacket and shirt collar, and he said, "You got to get out the car, man. The car's on fire." Oh, okay. You know? So I get out the car, and I'm walking away from the car, and I'm feeling in my pockets in my jacket, and I got my cigarettes, but I don't have my lighter. And I turn around and look at my car, and my car is this flaming, molten, smoking wreck. And for 1 minute, I thought about lighting my cigarette on the fire that was my car. You know, don't tell that story to your mom. I'm just going to put that out there. Like, normal people don't think that story's funny. But that, you know, that's kind of funny if you think about it. I have no idea how I talked myself out of that DUI. I had no license. I had no license on me. I had no insurance. I had no insurance on me. There's a six pack on the front seat. I talked the cop into giving me a ride to a payphone to go call my mom. Now, you would think, you know, losing the license and the SR-22 and having to move home with mom and dad, you would think that all of those things that you would, somebody would stop. Hey man, look, there's a problem here. You know, I didn't do that though. You know, the book talks about the hard drinker, the next drinker in the list, right? The one who exhibits some of the tendencies of the addict and alcoholic. He might die a few years before his time. But given sufficient reason, ill health, change of environment, falling in love, a warning from a doctor, he can stop and go in a completely different direction all on his own. My dad was a hard drinker. And the story is that one day when I was about 2 years old, my dad came home from work. Mom took my older brother to go shopping and left me home with the old man. The old man tied one on and passed out on the couch. And he woke up about 45 minutes later and he couldn't find me. Somehow or another, I had gotten out the front door and I literally was playing in the middle of the street. In the next 35 years, we who knew him and loved him can count on one hand how many drinks he took. Because he said, I ain't doing that no more. And he went in a completely different direction all on his own. And I have no idea what that's about. I stole from my family, and I stole from my friends, and I stole from jobs, and I wrecked cars, and I went to jail. I did all these things that we say we're never going to do. I got lines in the sand that'll walk me from here to Miami. None of those things ever stop me. You know, I am not a hard drinker. You know, so I'm not a moderate temperate drinker. I'm not a hard drinker. There's only one thing left, right? So the book says there's the hopeless variety, the real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know, so, get through all of that, whatever. One of the other fun things in the middle of all of that, I don't know about y'all, man, but when I get loaded, I tend to run my mouth. And, so I did that at work one day. And next thing I knew, I didn't have a job. So now I got no car, no job, living at home with mom and dad. Like, prospects are, you know, just great, right? Somehow or another, I kind of sort of cobbled a little bit together, and I ended up at this company called S&K Menswear. It was kind of like a mid-level clothing store in the 90s and the 2000s. They went bankrupt in 08. That wasn't exactly my fault. It is what it is, dude. Like, seriously. You know, I was able to put together a little bit of not drinking and using time. I'm not even going to call it dry time, much less sober time. I didn't drink and use long enough to figure out that S&K wasn't going to give me a test to take. And then once S&K wasn't going to give me a test to take, then I was back off to the races again. I went from Charleston to Augusta to Spartanburg with S&K. And this is one of the other things that I've learned about recovery and addicts and alcoholics, and the book tells us this. The book talks about this in two employers. It says that a sober alcoholic can do 2.5 the times the work of a normal person, right? The bottom line is we are very capable people. I go run a retail store tomorrow with my eyes closed. I do that in my sleep, you know? We are all amazing people. We are amazing people. I don't know. I know a couple of you. You're amazing people. We don't know what to do about that. Like, somewhere in the back of our minds, we know that we're very capable people, and it terrifies us because we just can't correlate that to how we're living the way that we're living. It just doesn't compute. You know? But I went from Charleston to Augusta and Augusta to Spartanburg, and I took me wherever I went. Imagine that. And so then what happened? That meant that the disease went with me where I went, and the disease continues to progress, so I have to find new and inventive ways to get my hands on money. You know, so now I'm getting the car title loans, and I've got a couple of payday cash advances, and I'm chasing these people, and these people are chasing me, and I'm robbing Peter to pay Paul, and this is how I'm living, you know? And I had an opportunity to come back to Charleston in 06. I'll never forget this, but it was October, and they offered me the store at the front of my neighborhood that I grew up in. My parents are still in the same house that I grew up in. And I called my dad, and I said, hey, man, look, they've offered me this store. I'm going to take it over. I'm going to come home. It's a mall store. It's mall holiday hours. It's going to be crazy. I've got to flip the entire staff over. I've got to whip the store into shape. I'm going to move in and crash with you until the end of the year and get the store through the holidays and get reset. And then come January, I'll move out. He was like, yeah, sure, man, come on. That was October of 2006. I moved out in December of 17. You know, we had the perfect storm. See, I was making really good money. I'm living back home with mom and dad now. They're paying all the bills. I ain't got no bills, right? About a week later, I call my man and he's like, meet me at the bar at the front of the neighborhood. I walk into the bar in the front of the neighborhood. It's like the high school neighborhood reunion center. I know half the people in the building. Dude, it was on. You know, a buddy of mine once said recently, it was something I love. He said, you know, we never spiral up. Growth is not a spiral up, but we always spiral down. And dude, the next 2 years was a whirlpool. It was real fast. It was real bad and it was real fast. The next real red letter day to come was about a year after that. And same typical scenario, you know, Wednesday night, I'm at the bar and, you know, I get my man to, you know, front me something, you know, that lie that we tell. I'm going to have money tomorrow, right? That's that lie that we tell. So the next day I'm closing up the store. I'm standing in front of the cash register, closing up the store. It's 8:45 and he's on the phone with me. Where's my money? And suddenly I had this thought. There's $1,000 in this drawer. Vaguely in the back of my mind, Lee, you ain't be robbing up the till. Reassuredly though, I'm the store manager. They ain't gonna know. I'm gonna put it right back. It'll be okay. I had a new bank. I mean, I may as well go ahead. I got to get his money. Now I'm going to go ahead and get a little extra because I got to go to the bar. A new bank. Cash anytime I want it. How do you think that worked out, right? About a year later, I sat my parents down to explain to them that I was a thief and a liar and that I was going to go to jail because there was a half a dozen deposit bags underneath my bed in my room missing about $2,000 in cash that I had no way to put back. I'm 30-odd years old, and I'm sitting here having this conversation with my parents. Now, you could have hooked me up to a lie detector test, and I promise you I'd have passed it, that all I was trying to do was warn them. My old man's a little slicker than that, a little smarter than that. He was like, you just wanted me to save your ass again. And he did, because he didn't know what else to do. And see, if you spend enough time in recovery, that's one of the other things that you're going to learn about is this thing called codependency. And I'm going to be clear. I'm not knocking it. Like, it's a real thing. There's a meeting for it. However, though, having said that, I have to be 100% honest about who I am. I am a world-class top-of-the-food-chain manipulator. And I spent a long time doing that to a lot of people who really cared about me. And that's just the way that it was. So we put the house of cards back together. We put the money back and I didn't lose my job and go to jail. And while we're at it, let's go ahead and pay off the car title loan again. And let's pay off the cash advances again and cobble this deal together where every 2 weeks when I got paid, I'd sign the back of the check and hand it to mom and dad and they would give me a couple of bucks. And we did that for like 3 months. Now, you got to understand, I still haven't correlated the problem here. Like, I haven't correlated the cause to the effect. Like, I still have to find some way to control. Like, I don't need to stop drinking and using. I just got to control, right? The book talks about that, control and enjoy. Let me be very clear, man. If I'm controlling the amount that I'm putting in my system, I am not enjoying life. And if you're around me, you ain't enjoying life either, I promise. And if I'm enjoying the amount that I'm putting in my system, there is absolutely no control. Because that's what my history says. That's what my record says, you know? 3 months later, we got everything put back together again, and then my parents hit me with the, hey, we need to go up to Baltimore and check on your grandfather. My grandfather was 91 years old. He was living in the same row house that he had bought in 1941. He'd been by himself. He'd been widowed about, widower about 20-odd years. You couldn't pry him out there with a crowbar if you tried. And they said, look, we just need to go check on him. And I said, yeah, sure, go, no problem. Everything's fine, right? By the time they got back, I had blown through my next paycheck and $3,000 of the company's money and quit my job because they won't catch me if I'm not there. That's what I did. I went to jail on Cinco de Mayo. For whatever that's worth. And look, I want to be clear. I'm not going to pretend to tell you that I went to jail. I did 30 hours in county. Look at me. Do I look like I'm built for jail? Like real talk. You know, that's, no, you know. So I got out and I got lucky and I got on PTI, right? Pre-trial intervention. You know, they end up sending you to these, you know, why drugs and alcohol are bad classes, right? You know, they teach you about, you know, halt, right? They teach you about people, places, and things. They teach you about triggers. I love triggers. I only have one trigger. It's consciousness. If I'm awake, you know, and see, and that's the other thing about this disease, man, and we're going to get into this in a minute. We start talking about the steps for a little bit, but I want to be very clear. This only makes sense to an addict or an alcoholic. Here is everything that you could ever want in your life. Here is your family, everyone that you love, all that you could ever want, all that you could ever have, all your hopes and dreams and aspirations. Here's everything. And here's Coors Light. Ask that to a normal person, right? Ask that to an addict or an alcoholic. You get a very different answer. That's what I was stuck in. That's what I was stuck in. I made it through PTI. I kept going to the IOP. I kept going to the classes. I had even, you know, gotten the woman to give me the HIPAA form. I would take a drug test. Matter of fact, I was thinking about this the other day. So I would take a drug test every week and they pick up the phone and call mom. He's okay. I did that for 2 years, right? I went back to school. I got all the charges expunged. I got some money back. I bought a car. Well, I got a car from my parents. I want to say I bought a car. That's the other fun thing about this little, you know, career as an actor alcoholic. When I started drinking and using on a regular basis, I was like 21 years old and I could fit everything that I owned in two boxes in the back of a car that I bought from my parents on credit that I hadn't really paid them for. And then, you know, 11 and a half, 12 years later, when I was going through IOP and I started putting my life back together again, I could fit everything that I owned in two boxes in the back of a car that I bought from my parents on credit that I hadn't really paid them for. Nothing to change. This is failure to launch, right? Went back to school. I had this little job down the road, whatever, you know what I'm saying? And I was making a couple of dollars and back home living with mom and dad again because that's about the only place that I can, you know, keep a roof over my head. And, first two semesters, dean's list, right? Crushing this thing called school, right? Yeah. You know, going to these IOP classes. They even gave me the opportunity to teach the class. Like I would sub in and stuff, right? I knew something was wrong. And look, I'm not trying to knock the medical establishment. There's a lot of doctors out there who really try to help us. And they do. They help us some. But in the end, for a lot of us, doctors can only but do so much. And I even talk about this when I do my step one, my three-part illness workshop. I always preface it with what I call doctors can't help. And there's multiple passages in the book where the doctor says, look, for a certain class of addict and alcoholic, I can't really do much for them. It'd give me a straitjacket in a padded room, right? That'll work. But at some point, he's got to let me out. At some point, he's got to let me out to leave me to my own devices to start making all my own choices again, right? We talked about that a minute ago, right? Not real good at making those choices, right? And, so 2 years, you know, two semesters, things are going well. And then mom and dad do it again. We need to go up to Baltimore and check on your grandfather. Sure, go. No problem. Everything's good. Figured out how to beat the drug test, you know? Took the drug test Saturday morning, got high as a bitch for 24 hours straight, and then sweat it out for the next 6 days and pray up and down that I pass the next one. Did that 4 weeks in a row. And at the end of those 4 weeks, I'd blown through every nickel that I had, and there was some random dude that my parents didn't know calling their house looking for me. And I was getting ready to fail out of school. And I had no idea what had just happened. No idea. The book talks about it. The book says we start so nonchalantly and then we pound on the bar. How did I get here again? How did I get here again? And I was there again. Now, if you're like me, you know, when you realize that you're in trouble, the first thing you got to do is get out in front of it. I got to mitigate the consequences here, right? I'm in trouble, you know, so... I'm such a martyr. 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, victimhood, right? I called my brother, and I called him to apologize to him for ruining Thanksgiving that was coming up. I swear to God, that's what I did. And he told me, he said, look, man, you need to go to a meeting. And I said, okay. He said, mom and dad are coming home today. You need to go to a meeting. Tell them what's going on. And, you know, I said, okay. And I ended up going to Somerville, and I went to this meeting. It was a different fellowship. And you know how some of the rooms, some of the meetings, when they finish up all the readings, before they open the meeting up, they say, does anybody have anything that they need to get off their chest? I hurled all over those people for the next 20 minutes straight. I was a broken, bawling, blubbering mess, dude. I just didn't get it. I went home after the meeting, and when I got home, my mom told me that my brother had sent me an email. And in the email, there was a phone number, and it was a phone number, and it said, I want you to call this guy tomorrow. And see, and this is the other thing about, you know, when we're in trouble, we're willing to do what anybody's telling us to do if they think that it might help us get out of trouble. Yeah, sure, I'll call this guy, right? The next day, I called him. And maybe for the first time in years, I finally got honest with somebody. Look, man, I got a problem with drugs and alcohol, and I don't know what to do about it, and it's killing me. Like, I'm losing my mind over here. And he started talking step 12 over the phone with me. He started working step 12. He started talking three-part illness over the phone with me. He started talking allergy, obsession, spiritual malady over the phone with me. And look, I mean, by now, I've got this allergy. When I start, I can't stop. I've got this obsession that this time it's going to be different, right? And that we've talked about that a lot. You've been to enough meetings where we talk about this time it's going to be different. There's another lie that we tell, too. You know, and really, truth be told, in the last couple of years, this lie has become very prevalent. And that lie is, screw it. I don't care. Guys, I've been around for a while. When I came in that door for the first time, $5 would not kill you. And $5 will kill you today. That is the bottom line, you know. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying. This idea that I don't care, screw it, I don't care, that kills people. It really does. I've seen it. We've all seen it, right? Especially in the last couple of years. It's bad. But this guy started talking three-part illness over the phone with me, and he got me to another meeting that night. And I had my first real epiphany in recovery that night. You know, we were reading pages 64 through 66 in the book. It was a big book meeting. It was a Monday night. It was like 25 people in the room. I'd never looked at the 12 steps before. I'd never looked at the big book before. I had ignorance prior to investigation, right? In my mind, we're going to do these 12 things and life's going to get better. Do you know who I am? That's not going to work. I swear to God, right? So we're reading these pages, and then after that, they opened up the meeting and they start sharing. And this cat says, look, man, I did my step 4, like I did my inventory, but this one thing keeps coming up and I keep talking to my sponsor about it and I just don't know what to do about it. And then somebody else chimed in and said, well, look, man, if you already did the inventory work, but this thing keeps coming up, you know, and you keep 10-stepping it and that's not working, then you need to go back and write another 4-step and take another look at, because there's something that you're missing. And in that moment, I got it. Oh, they do the steps more than once. Oh, the program's cyclic. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. See that thing that I said earlier on when we got rolling here? Drugs and alcohol are a lifestyle. Recovery's a lifestyle. I got to start living this thing called recovery. I've probably written 20 inventories in 12 years. You know, I'm in the middle of a new set right now at this moment. I made a step 1 powerless list. Right? And I correlated all of the people involved and all these things that's going on in my life that I'm powerless over right now. I made a step 2 insanity list, which looks exactly like the step 1 powerless list. Imagine that. I made a step 3 list about what I'm not making a decision to talk to God about, which it looks exactly like the step 2 and step 1 lists. Imagine that. Every time I write an inventory, I could sit here and tell you that life is great. Everything is fine. Every time I write an inventory, it's 25 pages of fear, pride, and ego. That's what it is. I am a selfish, self-centered, fear-driven addict and alcoholic. And if I want something and you're in my way, or if I think you owe me something, whoo boy, we got problems. Do not let me get entitled. That's a problem. A couple of weeks later, this guy, he gave me a big book, right? And I still have that white chip phone list. And on the front of the white chip phone list, it's got doctor's opinion 164. You got to read the book. The instructions to getting and staying sober are in the book. You know, okay, I'll read the book. And I do this with new guys when I get a hold of them, you know, especially. And if it's in a meeting like this, I'll pull them off to the side because I don't want to embarrass them. But I ask him, you got a big book? Yeah. Have you read the book yet? No. And then I'll pull him off to the side. If that book was the instructions to unlimited money and relationships, would you read the book? You'd be telling me about the book. Right? The design for living that solves all your problems is in that book, The Instructions to Getting and Staying Sober. And that's what my sponsor said to me, and I said, okay, I'll read the book. And I read it. And then 2 weeks later, he pulled me aside again, and he said, look, man, you got a car, because I actually still had the car this time around. You need to be giving dudes rides to meetings. And I had met another guy who had started a recovery community, and he had a sober house at the meeting. And I said, hey, man, can I go by your sober house and pick up your dudes and take them to meetings if they want to go? He said, yeah, sure, no problem. And so I would pick up the phone 5 days a week and call them. Hey, guys, I'll be there in 20 minutes. Y'all get ready. And put four dudes in my car, and we would go bombing down 26 or 526 with the bumper scraping. Got 7 months sobriety between all of us. You know, no idea what's going on. We're telling each other about the stuff that our sponsor's telling us. I was able to connect with those guys. Man, see, and that's, I tell this to people all the time. I've been around for a while. It's very possible that there's some newcomers who are not going to be able to hear what I have to say because they can't see that far. But that dude who's got 30 days can reach that man because he can see 30 days. He can't see 12 years, but he can see 30 days. Get out there, carry that message. Somebody needs to hear what we got to say. If you got 30 days and he's got 15, you got 15 more than him. You know, if you've got more sober time right now than you've ever had before in your life, then you're in a new place and you can help somebody get there too. That's the bottom line. This is what we do. And so I started taking these steps. You know, step one, allergy obsession. Yeah, that's easy. Powerless. Sure. No problem. I'll walk in the room anywhere in the world and be like, yeah, I got a problem with drugs and alcohol. we don't have to really discuss that anymore. This unmanageability thing, though, I needed some help with that. You know, this, you know, life is unmanageable. My sponsor pulled out page 52. He pulled out the bedevilments. We were having trouble personal relationships. We can't control our emotional natures. We're a prey to misery and depression. We have a feeling of uselessness. We're full of fear. We're unhappy. We can't seem to be of real help to other people. He said, Lee, when you're out there drinking and using, is that what your life is like? Yeah, that's why I'm drinking and using. Lee, when you're not drinking and using, those couple of times where you put together a couple of weeks, is that how your life was going? Hell yeah. Boy, isn't that interesting. See, it doesn't matter whether drugs and alcohol are involved. The outside circumstances have nothing to do with how I feel inside. You know, the bottom line is the reason why life is unmanageable is because I don't manage life well. There's a little line on page 60. If you go to an AA meeting, you'll hear they read how it works. You know, that reading at the beginning of the meeting that nobody pays attention to, you know, because we're looking at our phones or checking out this new relationship we're about to destroy, you know, how it works. Right. Well, right there at the end of that, it says, though, you know, it says that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives My sponsor asked me a question. He said, Lee, he said, is your life unmanageable because you are powerless over drugs and alcohol? No. See, if the answer to that question was yes, then that line would read that we were alcoholic so we could not manage our own lives. It says we were alcoholic and we cannot manage our own lives. Very interesting thing. See, real recovery starts once the drinking and drugs stops. Why? Because without recovery, I'm going to start drinking and using again. What my home group says is abstinence followed by the 12 steps. I have to stop doing the thing and then I have to take the steps or I'm going to start doing the thing again. Makes sense, right? Nobody ever explained any of that stuff to me. You know? The bottom line is, there's no God in step one. You can look at the steps on the wall. It's the only step where God is not mentioned. What we talk about in step one is the lack of God. There is no God in the way that I'm living right now. And then that led me right into step two, and I love step two because step two is the simple step, but it wraps it all home for me. I have to work step two backwards. The most important word in step two for me is the word sanity. If I think living in step one makes sense, that's crazy, right? I've got 1,000 insane stories. Everybody in this room has 1,000 insane stories. Go tell one of your insane stories to a normal person. They will look at you like you got six heads. And then you'll say something like, yeah, dude, that was Tuesday. Wait till I get money, you know? It's, dude, the holidays, yo, New Year's is this weekend, bro. Just wait. Right? But see, here's the thing with that. Until I embrace that, I'm never asking anybody for any help, much less a God that I can't see. And then if we look back at those bedevilments, right, we look back at how I'm having trouble with personal relationships and can't control my emotions, and we go back and look at those bedevilments, we realize that left to our own devices, without a God in our life, without a set of spiritual principles to follow, the best that I can do is be in that spot. The best that I can do is be in a position to where I'm going to go burn it all down again. Because I don't like how I'm feeling, and I don't like what I'm seeing, and I don't like you. I'm out. There's a paragraph in 151, 152, and it talks about the spiritual malady. It says, the boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits, he fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take a half a dozen drinks and get away with them. How many times did I have like 45 days or 30 days? And for me, it was my parents' friends. You look so good. We're so glad you're doing so well. And I'm like, yeah, please go away. Yeah. I'm about to lose my mind right now. Yeah. I'm out. Uncomfortable in my own skin. My sponsor says, powerless over the way that I'm feeling. Stay sober a couple of years and do that again and realize that step one list of powerlessness, that step two list of insanity, I got 2 years of shit that I've been smoking. Because I'm either applying spiritual principles or I'm being alcoholic. There's no middle ground. I got 2 years. I got an inventory full of stuff that I've been smoking. That's what I've been doing. A couple of relationships in there. Anybody in here ever smoked a relationship? Whole different discussion entirely, right? They got meetings for that too. Just throwing that out there. That leads me into step three. Made this decision to turn my will and my life for the care of God as we understood Him. I have to make this conscious choice to go in this new direction, right? See, I've been seeking, I've been trying to, you know, money and jobs and cars and status and women. None of it's ever worked. You know, for the first time in my life, I'm going to go seek God as I understand God. And that's the beauty of this program. This is not religion. You can call it whatever you want. God, Allah, Buddha, Minerva, Zeus, Jupiter, Shiva, Ra, Yahweh, Jehovah, Father Time, Mother Earth, Spirit of the Universe. Pick one. For thousands of years, billions of people have been seeking a higher power, and they seemingly had good lives. My life is hell right now. Yeah, give me some God. Let's go. Anything's got to be better than the way that this is getting. And so I make that decision and I go right into steps four and five. And I'm going to write this inventory. I'm going to get honest about how I got right here. I'm going to talk about all the people that I'm mad at. That's the easy one. And I'm going to talk about what I did. And I want to be clear. We bastardize the words in recovery by accident. We don't mean to do it. Nowhere in the book does it say my part. It says we resolutely look clear, casting aside the wrongdoings of others, we resolutely looked for where we were to blame. What did I do? Yes, they might have done something wrong, but we're not talking about them. What did I do? And then I'm going to go and write down all my fears, because boy, I walked in the door saying I wasn't afraid of nothing, right? Afraid of everything. I'm afraid that you're going to know that I'm afraid. That's why I couldn't walk in the door to begin with. I couldn't walk into a room full of people because you were going to know. I'm going to talk about all these relationships, right? Look, I'm going to go ahead and tell you right now, everybody's sex inventory looks like an episode of SVU. It is what it is. It's okay. Let's get it on paper. Let's go. And then we get to step five, and now I'm going to share it with somebody else, and God's going to be in the room. You know, I'm not going to pretend to tell you that I got saved, but I walked out of there a hell of a lot lighter. Because I finally had got to talk about some stuff that had just been eating at me for years. And then we got into six and seven, and this is where the miracle really starts to happen. You know, because when I walked in the door at step one, I was broken and I had nothing. And six steps later, now I'm talking to God. And I'm not talking Adam, hey man, I'm in trouble again. I'm talking to him, hey man, without you, I'm going to be afraid that I'm not good enough. Hey man, without you, I'm going to be afraid that nobody likes me. Hey man, without you, like I'm talking to God. If that's not a miracle, I have no idea what is. And that leads me right into eight and nine, and now we got some more work to do, right? And I'm going to go ahead and tell you right now, if you've been in recovery long enough, you might have seen this as well. We lose people at three places. We lose them at step one because they're not ready. We lose them at step four because they're not willing. And we lose the rest of them at step nine out of pure, unadulterated fear. It is terrifying to go back to these people that we know we harmed and say, what I did to you was wrong. That is terrifying. It's also unbelievably humbling, and there is so much magic in it. The book implores us to do this. right? The 100 men and women who wrote the instructions to getting and staying sober implore us to do this. The book uses very big words like implore and abandon. Those are very big words. Must, vital. The book doesn't play around with a whole lot of suggestions. It talks about real words. Abandon, implore, must, vital. If I want something different, there's a line in the doctor's opinion that says to recreate our lives. I come in the door saying I got to get this back and I got to get back that back. If I'm getting honest, I don't want that stuff back because it was all built on lies. I need something new. And if I knew how to build that, I wouldn't be here, but I don't know how to do that. And apparently you guys do. Now, if you've heard the term just for today, another phrase, I want to be very clear. 1 through 9, get me sober. 10, 11, and 12, keep me sober. 10, 11, and 12 is just for today. It says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, because they're all coming at once, we say a prayer, we talk to someone, we make amends, we turn our thoughts to someone we can help, right? Think about what your sponsor said to you when you first came in the rooms. Hey, before you push the big red button and throat punch that dude, why don't you give me a call? Right? And then we look at step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact. And then here it is, asking only for his knowledge. What'd your sponsor have you do? I want you to pray on your knees in the morning. And I want you to ask God to keep you sober that day. And then at the end of the day, I want you to get on your knees and pray again and thank God that he kept you sober that day. Right? These are the daily instructions to staying sober. And if I do these things, I will stay sober. And then step 12, try to carry the message. I can't make you get the message, but I can try to give you the message. And then here's the real one. Practice these principles in all my affairs. Like my relationships and my money, right? See, I can't negotiate with God anymore. I can't say, look, man, you take the drugs and the alcohol, I'm going to keep the women and the money. Can't do that no more. Doesn't work. Yeah? But if I do these things, I will stay sober. And the book guarantees that. There's a whole lot of promises in the book. But there's one guarantee, and the guarantee is that if I do what the book tells me to do for 24 hours, I will stay sober for those 24 hours. And if I string enough of those 24 hours together, life starts to get real good real fast. And that's a damn sight better than I ever had when I was out there running and gunning, and I will take it. Yes, let me get some more of that. And life is really, really good today. I was thinking about this on the way up, man. You know, in 12 years, there have been countless weddings and countless births. I've given out more anniversary chips. I've sponsored more people. There's also been, you know, some other, you know, life is life. You know, there's been some funerals and there's been some tragedies. There's been some heartbreak. You know, I mean, I've broken some hearts and they've broken mine. But you know what? I got to live through all of that. I didn't exist. I got to live through all of that. I got to experience that. I've lived more in the last 12 years than I did in the first 34, I guarantee you. I'll take that, man. I'll take it all day. 5 years ago, a friend of mine put my phone number in the window of this truck at a Total Wine in West Ashley because there was a guy passed out in the truck. And on that piece of paper, she wrote, if you ever need any help, call this guy. And 2 days later, he called me. And it turned out he lived in Somerville, which is, if you know anything about Charleston, is way the hell on the other side of town. How he ended up passed out in the parking lot in West Ashley, it's the disease, right? So I chatted with him for a bit, and I sent him out to the Step Up Club in Somerville because I got some people out there, you know? I chased my dope man all over the state. I go to meetings all over Charleston, you know? I was talking about this with somebody literally on the phone earlier today, and I straight up said to him, hey, man, you know, I always had time to get high, so I promise you I've always got time to do recovery. So I sent this guy out to Somerville and plugged him into some people out there, and every couple of months I would hear about him or run into him or whatever. He seemed to still be around. This past Labor Day, I went out there for a little shindig they had, and out in the yard behind the Step Up Club, I saw this girl that I knew that was in recovery as well. I hadn't seen her in a while. I went out there to go and say hi, and as I got closer, I realized that she was pregnant, and she was with him, because they had met at the Step Up Club, and he got sober, and they got married, and they were expecting their first kid. And the first thing he said to me was, "Your phone number was in my window." Man, dude, you can have the dope back. You can have the dope back. You know, to be an ancillary character on a miracle that is three lives, I'll take all of that and more. You know, I've got so many gifts to tell you. I could spend days talking about how wonderful my life is and some of the wonderful things that have happened. I can't give it to you, though. I wish I could give it to you. But like I said before, I don't care who you are, where you are, how you got there. If you need some help finding yours, I will help you find yours. You let me know. And God knows, I hope you do. Anyway, my name's Leo Natica. Thank you for your time.